Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and this is your antidote to popular talk radio. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Wednesday, April 20th, 2011. It is now around 7.01 p.m. Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Well, good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call toll-free 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Or you can send us your email anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. This evening, folks, we are pleased to have Andy Sutton, the chief strategist for Sutton Associates. He will be returning to our program. We have him every third Wednesday of the month now. We're pleased about that. We're so happy that he has agreed to join us during that time. And this evening, we'll be discussing the general economy, the labor market, commodity prices, prospects for inflation from QE3, QE4, and you name it. We do want you to participate in this program, and we do want you to call in 888-773-4496. And I do believe he's on the air now. Andy, is that you?
Hey, Joe, how are you?
Fine. I'm doing pretty well. I've been through a couple of rough spots, but I think I'm working through them, you know, on my own accord, more so than with my doctor's help. I mean, less so with my doctor's help. Let me put it that way. So I'm in good spirits now because I'm on the way to being normal again, which makes me feel really good because I'm usually very active and running around. And when I don't feel well, boy, I am one miserable person to be around. I hope you're well. Andy, are you there? Uh-oh. We just lost Andy. Uh-oh. We lost our caller. Holy smoke, we lost our caller. Let's see if he calls in again, folks. Well, Andy's with Sutton Associates. He's the chief strategist, and he's an economist with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and he will be talking about, here he is again. Let's see what happens now. Andy, is that you again?
Well, hopefully the gremlins are out of the system now.
Did I hang up on you or what? What did I do wrong?
I don't know. I think the system just disconnected us. It probably doesn't like the topics for the show.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that, unfortunately. Well, you know, I was thinking, Andy, I don't know, what we're going to talk about. There's absolutely nothing happening.
No. Actually, if you'd be willing to forbear here for a couple of minutes, there's some, I don't know if this will end up being an editorial or what, but you know, I've got some thoughts on this whole national debt situation that I'd like to kind of throw out there, and it's really I've been guest lecturing at a local school here over the past couple of weeks, and it's been pretty interesting. And you know, some of the discussion has really spurred me to think about these things at a much higher level. And you know, so if you'd be willing to indulge me, I could kind of lay this out there, and hopefully use that as kind of a springboard into the rest of the show.
Oh yes, please do. Be my guest. In fact, you are my guest. Who am I? What am I saying?
Well, you know, and I think this is timely and appropriate because we've spent a lot of time over the past couple of weeks here in the media, you know, on television, the radio, what have you, arguing over the situation with the federal budget deficit and, you know, fiscal year 2012 and all of these types of things. And I think everybody's pretty much sick of that. And I want to kind of frame this a little bit and get some misconceptions out of the way that a lot of people have. The first misconception that a lot of people have is that this issue with the debt and big budget deficits and all of this stuff is a new creature, and that's entirely not the case. The second misconception is that a lot of people think that the situation with Social Security and Medicare and these types of things are also new animals,
yeah.
These problems, and they are. That's also false. That's not true either. Let's go back, if we will, to 1993, and Alice Rivlin, who was, at that point, that's probably not a household name, but she was in charge of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget for the government, and she commissioned three economists to do what's called a fiscal gap study. And one of those guys is a friend of mine, Larry Kotlikoff. Second was a cohort of his, Alan Auerbach, and the third was a fellow named Gokhale. And so these three guys were basically tasked with creating a fiscal gap analysis for the federal government. And what a fiscal gap analysis is, it basically takes the inflows and the outflows and runs them out over long periods of time. And the first work on this was actually done in the early 1930s by a guy by the name of Irving Fisher. And he called it two-period life cycle analysis, and that's pretty much the popular name, although it's been called generational life cycle analysis and other types of things. But generally, you're looking at periods of 75 years.
Okay.
And this is kind of where the government got this whole 75-year time span from, as far as looking out into the future. And what they really did not do is focus on what's called infinite horizon. But anyway, so these three economists are commissioned to do this work, and they do the work, and it doesn't go with the politics of the day. It doesn't jive with what that particular leadership administration was looking for. I mean, if you remember correctly, in the mid-1990s, they were talking about the government was running a surplus, and everything was great, and the fiscal situation was intact, and everything was going to be fine.
Right.
Well, this study threw eggs all over that.
Right.
Lots of eggs, and a couple of days before the budget was released, this got axed. This study got axed from the budget. So this was 1993 into 1994. That's 18 years ago.
Right.
So that's the first thing. Now, the second thing, you fast forward to, I believe it was 2002. One of those participants in the first study, Gokhale, him and a fellow by the name of Smetters, they were commissioned again to do another fiscal gap study that was supposed to go into the 2003 budget. And Paul O'Neill was involved in this. He was the Secretary of the Treasury
right.
at the time, and he was asked.
Right, he was a good man. I thought he was a very good man.
Right, there's a lot of speculation now that he was asked because he pushed hard for the inclusion of this fiscal gap study into the budget in 2003.
Right. I see.
Well, obviously, and again, you were looking at a situation where, there were political incentives, directions that people wanted to go, and again, this kind of threw egg all over a lot
right.
of that and pointed to a very serious problem, a growing problem.
Right.
Let's fast forward a couple of more years to 2006. One of the guys, the first guys who was commissioned in 1993 to do the first study, Larry Kotlikoff, he wrote a paper that appeared in the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis Review in the July-August issue of 2006. And he talked about this fiscal gap and the infinite horizon analysis. And they came up at that time with a $66 trillion fiscal gap, July
right.
and August of 2006. That was the same model that Gokhale and Smetters had developed back in 2002, if you can kind of follow the timeline here. So there's at least three warnings, all right?
Right.
And probably a fourth, because Greenspan and his commission, if you remember way, way back to 1982, they were charged with, quote-unquote, fixing Social Security back then already.
Right.
And obviously they missed the boat. Now, we can at least give them kind of, if you want, the benefit of the doubt, but there's no way that you can give government the benefit of the doubt from 1993 on. They have had 18 years, Joe, to work on this. They have had 18 years. They have done nothing. Absolutely nothing, nada.
Right.
For 18 years while Rome burned. These people did nothing. And now the media is coming out and it's acting like all of a sudden, like this is something, oh, we never knew this was the case. This is, terrible.
Right.
All of a sudden this happened and, we've inherited this mess from Bush. And
right.
Anybody who knows me knows I'm not a political creature.
Right.
I couldn't care. You know what? I couldn't care less if Donald Duck was in the White House. What happened, happened.
That would be an improvement, by the way. But
right.
But I digress.
So anyway, this 2006 now, and this was one of the things that really lit a fire under my behind, and this is one of the reasons why when I read this paper of Kotlikoff back in 2006, this is one of the things that actually caused me to go public with some of the work that I was doing, and that was when 2 cents started to appear.
Right.
Anyway, that's kind of an aside. This was an important, the point is this was important stuff, and it was totally hidden. There was a few obscure articles, but anyway. So that was $66 trillion in 2006. The last measurement that we got out of that same model is $202 trillion, and that was about 3 months ago.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So this thing has more than tripled in 5 years, a little less than 5 years.
Well, just generally, what I've heard figures like $59 trillion, $85 trillion, and they float around there. What makes it go from that type of figure to a 200 trillion figure? What's the big, that item, which is the main increase, increases it all?
Well, this is the infinite horizon fiscal gap of the whole federal government. You know, when you hear the 59 trillion, that's Social Security or Medicare. It depends on whose numbers you're looking at and what day you happen to hear them.
Right.
This is the whole ball of wax. It is, you can't comprehend that number. It's impossible for the human mind to even comprehend $1 trillion.
Yeah.
You know, they have these things on the internet where, they show you like a warehouse filled with dollar bills and that would be $1 trillion or, it'd be so big or whatever. You know, we can't even get our minds around this. It's such a huge number. The point is, I'll go on record right here. What is it, April 20th here, 2011?
Right.
This will never be paid back.
Right.
Will never be paid back. And I got, obviously, it'll never be paid back in conventional terms. I'm going to take it a step further, Joe. This will never be paid back, period.
Right. Yeah. Well, the only way I can...
They won't even be able to pay this back with hyperinflated dollars.
Yeah. The only way I can conceive of $202 trillion is thinking of my wife in a shoe store. But other than that, I have very lot of difficulty.
Let me just kind of frame this for people. And let's go back to 2006 for a minute. People need to get their heads around this as best they can.
Right.
And I'm going to read right from Larry's article. The Gokhale and Smetters measure of the fiscal gap is a stunning $65.9 trillion. This figure is more than five times U.S. GDP and almost twice the size of national wealth. One way to wrap one's head around $65.9 trillion is to ask what fiscal adjustments are needed to eliminate this red hole. Now, mind, this is in 2006. The answers are terrifying. One solution is an immediate and permanent doubling of personal and corporate income taxes. Another is an immediate and permanent two-thirds cut in Social Security and Medicare benefits. The third alternative, were it feasible, would be to immediately and permanently cut all federal discretionary spending by 143%.
Those are big figures.
That was 2006. That was when it was $65.9 trillion.
Right. I have some of my friends have very close friends who are in the Secret Service. And it's interesting. They say that the only thing that they've ever learned from their friends in the Secret Service was one thing. And he says that this is the first thing that they learn when they get indoctrinated into the service, I guess. And
how
that is...
funny money?
What's that?
How to spot funny money?
No. Actually, you know what they say? They say the first thing we learn is that we will always be at war. Now, taking that from a financial point of view... if that is true, if we will always be at war, and so far we have always been at war in one way, shape, or form, And if going forward we will always actively be in war, that means we're going to spend somewhere in the vicinity of $1 trillion on military every year. Well, there's no way we can catch up once we do that, plus the Social Security and all the other things.
Right.
So, you know, when they speak about this on television, they go, well, we can cut this as $150 million. No one talks about the military. I mean, it's sacrosanct.
Oh,
you know, it's the most ridiculous thing.
You know, the most interesting thing about all of this is we battled, not we, you as in you and I, but we as a nation were, embroiled in this battle in the budget, for, 5 weeks?
Right.
And when it was all said and done, when all the dust cleared, they cut, $38 billion
right.
or something like that from the budget? And these guys are going around, and everybody's patting themselves on the back. You know, Joe, that's like you and I taking a walk down here to the nearest ocean and spitting into it.
That's right. And what's interesting is that those figures, as you know, I mean, you know better than I do, that are... it's really not $38 billion being reduced on the actual
right.
budget. A lot of that money is money that we're going to increase the budget by, but we're not increasing it as much. And the actual reduction,
right.
I've heard figures of in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's it.
Yeah, CBO came out with their work, their angle on that whole thing. It was a couple of days after. The smoke had cleared. They said it was $315 million sticks
yeah.
in my mind was the actual savings.
Right.
You know, and I threw my hands up. You know, how many, Joe, we spent more money than that just having, politicians fly all over the place and campaign for this cut or that cut or
That's
this
right.
bill or that bill.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this is insanity.
Right.
What's going on here.
Yeah.
This will, and this is why I say, this will never be paid.
Oh yeah, well they're talking
this will
about.
Never be fixed.
Yeah, they're talking about Obama's campaign now will cost over $1 billion. Well, if his campaign just to stay in office is going to cost over $1 billion and is saving $300 million, I think we have a
right.
problem.
Yeah.
Let's stop for station.
And the thing is whoever goes up against him is going to have that much. And so, you know, you're talking about $2 billion,
right.
which is six times and change. What they saved. It's a joke.
Right.
You know, it would be funny if it weren't so serious.
That's right. Let's stop for station identification so everyone knows who we are and who you are.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure libertarian talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Folks, this evening we have Andy Sutton, economist and chief strategist for Sutton Associates, Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're discussing about everything that has to do with the economy. We encourage you to call with your questions toll-free, 888-773-4496, 888-773-4496. If you want to call direct, it's 646-652-4620. Of course, your comments are welcomed anytime to comments@libertytalkradio.com. What bothers me is that I speak to people who are otherwise intelligent people. They're in business or they have good jobs with major corporations, good educations, they're mature, otherwise they're rational. But when it comes to politics and it comes to the economy, it is incredible the misconceptions that they are under and those beliefs that they hold so dearly, they will not change their minds.
I'm going to tell you something else. You know, we were just talking about misconceptions here, and now you just rattled my brain again. You know, there's another big misconception going around right now, and it's largely among adults, and that is that the U.S. dollar is backed by gold.
Yeah, that's right. That's
I know
right.
that's kind of totally unrelated to what we're talking about, but you said misconceptions, and it just kind of jumped out. That's probably the big kahuna of all misconceptions.
Well, you know, and we do things like we propagandize, I guess, and it eventually becomes part of our psyche that it is necessary, it's required that we get involved in everything that's going on around the world. Absolutely everything. If there's someone does something in some far off country, I mean, we have got to be there, because if we're not, who will? And no one thinks through that. No one says, why do we have to go there in the first place? Well, we're the only ones that can. And they give the most lame excuses, the stuff that you hear on television. And they're otherwise intelligent people. And you can't argue that, because you just want to say, that's the dumbest damn thing I've ever heard in my life. And then the conversation ends. I had a conversation with a guy who's, I mean, an older guy, I mean, really bright. And it is incredible what this guy was saying about, you know, our military and our spending and how necessary everything was. No, absolutely no concept of economics or the worldview. Absolutely none. Almost as if we pulled our troops out of all of the countries around the world, all of these countries would be begging us to give us the people, that is. They would be begging us to give us our troops back to them. You know, it's incredible that they believe that. And I guess with that type of mentality, I don't think we stand much of a chance.
Well, you know, a lot of this stuff has become institutionalized, too. I mean, you take the situation with, you know, entitlements. And, you know, I read a piece here about an hour ago that the U.S. government actually handed out more cash benefits, transfer payments, as they like to call them, than they took in taxes. You know, and usually that constitutes a fiscal tipping point. Obviously, $202 trillion, and it's more than that now, because that number's a couple of months old. Obviously, multiple hundreds of trillions of dollars don't do it. Well, maybe the fact that we're paying out more than we're taking in, you know, just in terms of, you know, entitlement programs and benefits, you know, it's not sustainable.
Yeah.
It's not even, you know, and it's becoming, you know, a while ago, people, this is a long-term problem. This is not a long-term problem anymore. Now it's a short-term problem.
Right, absolutely.
You know, just look at what happened in Europe. You know, they get to a point, you get to 13-14% of GDP is your deficit, and all of a sudden, boom, these guys start dropping like dominoes.
Right.
You know, we don't know where our tipping point is.
Right.
You know, there's people can predict, and we can talk about it, and we can, you know, we can build models and do all this kind of stuff, but nobody really knows exactly when it's going to happen. I've been saying for a long time now, it'll go until it doesn't, and when
it doesn't,
then your world's going to change forever.
Like a friend of mine says, some morning we'll wake up and turn on the news or whatever we do when we get up in the morning, and they're going to announce a bank holiday. And no one's going to understand, well, how did that happen? We have a caller on the line. You want to take the call, Andy?
Sure. Go right ahead. Let's do it.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, Joe, Andy. It's Jim here.
Oh, Jim. Hi. Thank you for calling in.
Jim from Tulsa, right?
You bet. Yeah.
How you doing?
Good. Well, you and Joe have guilted me into subscribing, and it's the best $99 I've spent. I really enjoyed the Sensible Investor, the audios, and the emails I get from you.
Jim, the gun wasn't loaded, Jim. I tell you, it wasn't loaded at all. I was only kidding.
No, really enjoy your thoughts and your insight. And as you know, you're in a minority of investment experts, advisors that are so awake and clear and direct about the macroeconomics, particularly. I'm sure you're good at the micro too. But anyways, you're in that small group of people who I have so much respect for. You know, Schiff, Rogers, Salente, Faber. I'm sure you got a handful of favorites too. But anyways, keep up the good work. And I think that you and that small group of people are day by day gaining more credibility. And hopefully that'll. I know you're doing it to awaken people and help advise people, but hopefully that'll also lead to better business for you.
Well, you know what? It's one of, like I said, you know, before when I was talking to Joe, you know, I read that piece back in 2006, and that was really what put a fire under me. It was like being hit in the head with a brick. And,
right.
You know, you almost felt obligated to try and join in and, you know, chip in and try to generate some kind of an awareness. I'm going to tell you what, it's been a long battle.
Well, Andy,
stuff that we talked about 5 years ago that was radical and extremist, all of a sudden now it's mainstream. So, you know, a lot of progress has been made, and that's a really good thing.
But, you know, Joe and I have laughed, and some of our other like-minded friends said, oh, yeah, we're really the life of the party, you know? It's real, you know, when people perceive some doom and gloom attitude, and all it is a reality check.
And it makes some people uncomfortable, but more and more what I'm finding is that they're starting to actually consider things. People are starting to ask more questions. They're starting to become interested in learning more about this stuff, and we need more and more and more of that. So, you know, and it's not just, you know, guys that write newsletters and do this kind of stuff. I mean, it's everybody. Anybody who has any kind of a, you know, awareness of this stuff, you know, talk to your friends, your family, coworkers.
At least that's
outspread.
Exactly. I agree with you. People that you love and care for, you have an obligation to at least point them in the direction or encourage them, and from that point, so you can only lead a horse to water, right?
Yeah, but you can also salt his oats.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, I hear you. Hey, quick question, and I'll let you guys go. I'm anticipating hyperinflation as a subscriber to inflation.us. You know, they've got me brainwashed. So I've done some things to prepare, both personally and investment-wise. But I hate to ask you a hypothetical, but I understand with hyperinflation that the exchange rate, as it drops, it can change almost hour by hour or day by day. So, you know, the Weimar Republic, I've heard that, you know, between morning and night, the rates, doubled or something.
Oh, yeah.
So my question is, realizing that anything is possible, and we could be, you know, facing very crazy times. Would the stock market inflate with other things? So if all of a sudden our dollar was only worth a dime, would the stock market multiply by 10%? Or is it just not that simple?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. And again, you know, on a day-to-day situation, sometimes you see that kind of correlation, sometimes you don't. Like today was a good example. The dollar dropped significantly against the euro. It dropped against silver in a big way. It dropped against gold. And the Dow went up. The S&P 500 went up. The NASDAQ went up. So sometimes you see it, and it's very neat and orderly like that. Other days, you don't get that at all. You know, the dollar will fall and the Dow will go with it. Generally speaking, you know, when you're talking about, you have to remember the inflation and where it comes into the system. Our inflation in America, most people are under the impression that it all comes from the Fed, and that's not actually true. Where our inflation comes from is the Fed can do it through their vehicles, open market operations and things like that, but much of the inflation is actually created by the banking system through fractional reserve banking. People make deposits, people borrow money. When people borrow money, that creates inflation. As crazy as that sounds, that's how it works. You put a deposit in there, they make loans, you know, you do $10 in, they do $100 out. So that creates a lot of inflation too. The kicker is, we have some control over that, and this is what's been going on for the last couple of years now. When the consumer retrenched a little bit with regards to credit card borrowing and consumer credit, and you saw that dip, and that's why I was screaming about that. We actually shut down M3 growth by doing that.
Wow.
If you look at the same period of time when that consumer credit dipped, you take a look at M3 growth, and you overlay those charts, and it's almost a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm.
So we stopped the inflation at the banking system. I shouldn't say we stopped it. We slowed it down at the banking system level. So what happened? The Fed started quantitative easing. They started doing the helicopter variety. So getting back to what your question is, if the inflation is created through the banking system, that means people are borrowing money, you know, deposits come in, loans go out, that kind of thing. That money may or may not get put into the stock market, but this quantitative easing money, this is targeted directly at the asset market, whether it's the bond market, and much of that QE money actually went into the stock market, not the bond market. It started out intended for bonds, and it went right over to stocks because bonds really have languished, even since they've been doing their quantitative easing. So it depends how a hyperinflation would go about happening.
Right.
You know, if the economy is suffering, you're not going to see people racing out to borrow money. Similarly to what happened over the past couple of years, I would imagine at that point that you would run into a situation where it would be more of along the lines of a massive quantitative easing effort. Now, another interesting point here is the wage situation. There's another misconception a lot of times that you need a wage price spiral to have hyperinflation. You can have hyperinflation without the wage price spiral. You can just have the price spiral, but the problem is the economy is going to tank, because people won't be able to afford anything, and people will be buying staple goods only. Discretionary spending will stop pretty much altogether. So when the Fed talks about the fact that there's no pressure on upward pressure, I should say, on wages, yet there's upward pressure on prices, that is not good. That means that the consumer is less able to keep up with the inflation that's being created. So those are things, you know, flagposts, if you will, that you can kind of watch out for, you know, in your own daily travels, and kind of, you know, kind of keep your finger on the pulse of this whole thing, you know.
Right.
And I think they're valid constructs, you know, keeping an eye on wages, keeping an eye on prices. And I'm not talking about this CPI. That's been jerry-rigged for about the same amount of time as you guys have known about this fiscal situation. So, you know, keeping an eye on prices, you know, in your own experience, keeping an eye on wages and those types of things. That's why I emphasize credit so much, because that's one of the biggest ways that inflation is created in our system.
Thanks.
I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Oh, yeah. You more thoroughly than I expected, and gave me, you know, a better perspective of things. So thanks a lot, Andy.
Yeah, you're welcome. Absolutely, no problem.
All right, we're all in this together, right?
Yes, we are.
All right, good night, guys.
Thank you very much, Jim, for calling in. All right, this is a good time to just stop for station identification, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Folks, this evening we're pleased to have Andy Sutton, economist and chief strategist with Sutton Associates, with us discussing the general economy, the markets, the labor market, the commodity prices, and anything else that you would like to discuss. Please call in toll-free, 888-773-4496. That's 888-773-4496. Now, folks, we have plenty of open lines. I know you're out there. I know you're listening because I see the stats. But please call in and don't feel that you're interrupting or you have a silly or stupid question. We would love to hear from you. Even if you think it's a stupid question, it probably is not. It's probably a very pertinent question. So please do call. If you want to send us an email, please send it to comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com.
You're listening to Liberty Talk Radio. Political talk derived from a historical perspective. Not always palatable, but good food for thought. Pure Libertarian Talk with host Joe Cristiano. LibertyTalkRadio.com.
Well, you know, Andy, what really disturbs me, and I realize that, you know, everything that's going on is upsetting, but what really truly disturbs me is the mentality of people and of the public in general. We have Timothy Geithner getting on national television, and he's being interviewed about the debt limit, and he says, "Oh, we have to raise the debt limit. It's our obligation to do so. The integrity and the integrity of the United States is on the line. Without increasing the debt limit, we could jeopardize the good faith and credit of the United States government." And I'm thinking to myself, it doesn't make any sense. In other words, you know, you're super bankrupt, and what we need to do is become even more bankrupt, and that resolves this solvency issue. Thus, we preserve our integrity. And when you think of the logic there, a mad person could never come up with that. And yet we take that, and the person interviews, "Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Geithner. I appreciate your coming here." The guy should have went, "Murr!" I should have started screaming at the top of his lungs. And I wish someone would just start screaming. I mean, the guy loses his job. You know, they'll be cut off. But at least they'll be on a YouTube for about, you know, 6 years. And just screaming, saying, "I can't believe what you..." And lunge for his throat or something. But I mean, I listen to this. I go, am I the only one hearing what this guy is saying? Or am I clinically nuts?
Joe, my blood pressure went up probably 50 points when he come out with that one. You know, the full faith and credit of the United States government is in jeopardy. And the first thing I'm thinking to myself is, you can't jeopardize what doesn't exist.
Right.
What we spent the first half hour talking about proves, you know, beyond reasonable doubt that there is no faith and full credit of the U.S. government.
Right.
You know, that was squandered over the past, you know, 90 or so years, you know, over with a variety of means. You know, and I want to just, if I can, get back to something that I think is also very important that people understand and take away from this. This is caused, I mean, yeah, politicians were in there and, you know, they did some silly things and really some imprudent things and all that. Yeah, we get that. But it all comes down at the end of the day to the idea of having a fiat currency that is backed by nothing, and it is lent to our government by a private corporate entity at interest. That is the bottom line. And that is the root of the problem, because when you think about it, when that first dollar came into our economy from the Fed at interest, and that's the important part, at interest, that means that we have to borrow another dollar to pay the interest on the first dollar, and
that's
so
right.
It goes.
That's right, and it deflates.
People need to understand that.
You know, it what is it absolutely incredible is that we have people in office who purport to be well-schooled and educated and have the experience in the area that they're in. And, you know, of course, they're a lot more intelligent than we are. But, you know, if you casually study history, you would know that what we're doing is all wrong. Now, are they reading different books? And then whenever something occurs, it's a surprise. I mean, nothing's a surprise to me anymore, and I'm not smart. I wouldn't qualify to fill any of those jobs. But at least I understand history and where we're going, and these people act as if everything is fine and nothing's going on. The same thing with our military. You know, they study the art of war. All cadets study the art of war, you know, written 4,000 years ago by the Oriental guy, you know. And it lays out the 30 major principles of war, you know, like, for example, don't stretch your supply lines. And they have all of these tenets. And quite frankly, I read there was a book printed, and it was a synopsis of the 30 points of this art of war. It was very, very interesting. And if you looked at what we did in Vietnam, we broke every single one of those rules. If you look at what we're doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Libya, breaks every one of those rules. My only point is that these people are schooled, they learn this stuff, and then they do the exact opposite. I don't understand that. Everything we do...
Well, it's not much different than economics, really. I mean, there's laws of economics. We know that... First of all, capital does not come from a printing press. That's rule number one.
Right.
The second rule is you'll never borrow your way to prosperity.
Right.
Rule number three is you'll never spend your way to prosperity.
Right.
We break those rules all the time.
Right. And
we wonder why there's consequences. We wonder why, you know, 17 generations or however many it's going to be are going to be burdened with our mistakes. And, you know, this is the thing, you know, I think it's willful. I mean, I honestly do. Because people, these guys that are in these positions, you know, you take a guy like Alan Greenspan. You know, back in the 60s and the 70s, Alan Greenspan was writing papers on how great the gold standard was, and how we
That's
needed
correct.
To, how it supported
right.
the currency and it underpinned everything and provided monetary discipline and all this other stuff. And then all of a sudden, he becomes the chairman of the Fed and he forgets all about that. You know, he didn't just forget about that.
Right.
I mean, this stuff is done because of greed. It's done for the enrichment of certain groups at the expense of others.
Right.
And, this whole thing that's going on right now is more of the same because, now this fiscal year 2012 budget, all of a sudden there's, this budget says, well, this isn't a problem now because we're going to have this, I forget what they're calling it here, but they're going to have this office or whatever that's going to recommend cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Yes, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, thanks. That's going to be doing that, and all of a sudden that's going to make everything okay. Well, they're going to recommend cuts. Well, guess what? Who's going to pay for those cuts? You are. I am.
Right.
Anybody who's on any of those programs, they're going to have to spend their other money for health care and retirement and all of these kind of things. And they may not get back what they put in. Frankly, Joe, I don't expect to get a dime out of Social Security, and I paid in, and I am paying in. This group, you, I, the middle class, whatever you want to call us, we're going to pay. That's going to be at our expense. But whose benefit is it going to be? Well, it's going to be the people that own the Federal Reserve, those 12 banks. They're getting very rich.
Right.
There's plenty of money, and all of that kind of stuff. So I mean, that's what our world is. It's always been about that. There's always people that are looking to, enrich themselves at the expense of somebody else, and we're not going to get away from that.
Right.
That's the human state.
Yeah.
The human state is flawed, and that's what we're going to have to deal with. That doesn't make it any easier to swallow for anybody.
Well, the woman who's head of the Social Security Administration, and I just don't remember her name at all. Twice I heard her interviewed, and both times she said, I'm not worried about Social Security. We are well-funded through 2040. But what she doesn't say is that she has IOUs through 2040. I can say, Andy, I'll be honest with you. I'm worth $40 billion, my friend Al, who's the alcoholic and a drug addict and hasn't worked a day in his life, he owes me $40 billion. So I'm a billionaire.
Yeah,
it's saying the same thing. I mean, but no one questions that. Everyone goes, oh, everything's okay. I think there's a desire, an innate desire to believe everything is all right because the physical manifestations today don't appear to be consistent what you and I are talking about. What you and I are talking about is absolute collapse, but yet you can still go to the store, you go to Macy's or you go to Sears and they have stuff on the shelves and they go, what is Andy talking about? Look, everything's here in
right.
the sale. People are selling stuff that got stuff on sale. I got paid on my check. And the thing is, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't, people don't call you and say, hey, tomorrow's going to be a little rougher than yesterday. It's not going to happen. It's insidious in that we do lose our purchasing power very, very, very slowly. And we feel the pinch a little bit more, but when it happens, we are going to be totally unprepared because we want to believe that everything is okay.
You can go to the Federal Reserve's website. I forget which of the 12 banks it is. The regional district banks, they have an inflation calculator on their website. I want to say it's not Philadelphia. It doesn't. You can find it. You can go there and you can put in what a dollar in 1913 is worth now, and it'll tell you it's worth about 4.5 cents or something
right,
like that,
yeah.
4.6, somewhere in there. Very little. That's one of their two mandates. The Fed's only two mandates they got. The first one was price stability, and the second one was maximum employment. Obviously, since they undertook the stewardship of the dollar, they've done a marvelous job at sacking it
right.
in terms of purchasing power, which is price stability or lack thereof, and this idea of maximum employment, they've, in my opinion, they've failed at that. As well, multiple times. Sure, people can find a job now. McDonald's just hired They had a hiring day, and they were looking to fill 50,000 positions. And I'm thinking, you know, this is the new paradigm. You know, people don't work for $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year anymore. Now we're going to battle over $8 and $9 an hour fast food restaurant jobs.
Right.
And this is obviously a result of offshoring, you know, and many factors that have, you know, we could spend hours talking about how we got to that point. The labor situation is not getting any better. The last report was pretty much the same as most of the reports, you know, before it. There was, there were jobs added, but most of it was that birth, death nonsense, temporary jobs.
Right.
And we fell well short of the number of jobs that actually need to be created just to break even with entrance into the workforce. And the worst thing that I'm seeing as far as the trend is that the workforce itself is actually shrinking, and that's why the unemployment rate's going down.
I see.
It's not because more people are employed, it's because less people are in the workforce, and that's how it's calculated. That's a problem. You've got people that are so discouraged, in BLS's definition of the word, that they actually fall out of the workforce. They haven't looked for work in so long, BLS just stops counting them. They're not collecting employment anymore. They're not looking for work, so they're out of the workforce. They're, and BLS just assumes that they just dropped off the face of the earth. And that's not true. And there's more and more and more of those people. And that's not healthy. That's not a healthy economy. Here's another anecdotal piece of information. I've been following gas prices. You probably read about this in the newsletter. But I'll share this little bit here. There is demand destruction going on now. And prices are an awful lot lower now on average than they were back in 2008. When we first started to see a little bit of demand destruction. This economy is not healthy.
Right.
You know, what that's telling me is, hey, the inelasticity of demand of gasoline is changing because people cannot afford it.
Right.
They swipe it on their credit card. Well, you know, those credit card rates have gone up a lot since the banks got bailed out.
Right.
So that's more expensive now. You know, people were working for $40,000 or $50,000 a year. Now they're making $18,000 because they took one of them McDonald's jobs. So I mean, this is things are not well. You know, and a lot of it's under the surface, and you have to really dig and pick. But if you look hard enough and you really, you know, churn it around and think about it, it's hard to come to a different conclusion. There's a lot of bad stuff going on.
Well, what about what's your prospect for the labor market in the future? Where do you see that going?
Well, there's a couple things that have to happen. First of all, what we have to do is we have to stop outfits like General Electric, and I'm just going to pick on them because everybody's heard about this nonsense, in the past couple of weeks. We have to stop incentivizing firms like that. We have to stop paying them to outsource jobs. We should, if we're going to pay them and we're going to give them pretty much amnesty on paying income taxes, you know, at the corporate level, then they need to bring those jobs back here to America. And they need to pay Americans to do those jobs, whatever they are.
Right.
You know, whether it's, you know, they do a lot of stuff. Now, obviously, you know, they build nuclear reactors, so they have to take people over because they do it in different countries. They have to pay, the local workers. I get that. But if jobs can be done here, they need to be done here. We shouldn't be outsourcing. That would need to stop first. And that's going to be an awfully hard sell because when you start comparing, you know, $1 an hour in China to $9 an hour here in America, it's hard to compete, at the price level, to have these things made here. It's going to be a difficult sell. People don't have the extra money, by and large. Some people, you know, they'll buy American where you can. I mean, I try to do it wherever I can. Some things, first of all, you just can't find things that are made here in certain instances. In others, you can find it, but it costs so much more that you can't afford it. So that's the first thing that has to happen. We have we have people entering the workforce constantly. You can read articles on 2009 and 2010's graduating classes from the different universities and that, and they're waiting tables, and working fast food joints and they're working at Starbucks and doing this kind of stuff. And that tells is not a number of good quality jobs.
Oh, yeah. I heard, Andy, I heard that
we need to make things here.
I heard that the unemployment rate currently for recent current college graduates, I forgot what the number is, but it was something like 85%. It was something incredible. And I couldn't wrap my head around the number. It was just too low. It wasn't 55%. It was much higher than that. And I wish I had the article there. And they say they're just not finding jobs.
Yeah, I don't know what the exact number is either, but I know it's very high amongst recent college graduates. And that is obviously, and that's a double whammy. Because first of all right, they're not working, they've spent all this money on their degree, and now they're not working in their field. But secondly, they have loans to service.
Right.
Those loans,
oh, yeah.
In many cases, are very huge.
And they may be paying for the rest of their lives on those loans. Now, here's something interesting. I saw a graph that showed that our manufacturing as a percent of GDP has remained about constant. It's a little down, but it's remained about constant since 1945. But the difference is that today we are manufacturing using robotics and the robotics, basically, and technology to build things when before we use raw labor. And the argument in this article, they say, well, people say, well, then you need people to build the robotics. The response to that is, no, robotics are building the robotics. And you know, right. if you see movies like the old Star Wars, the original Star Wars back in 1970s, that was portends the future. This is where we're going, you know? And look at the new Star Wars with those little character, whatever they... drones, you know, fighting the wars. And what we are doing now in Pakistan, we are sending drones over there. If we look at some of that science fiction, that's where we are going. Now, is some of our, a lot of our manufacturing, we are manufacturing for companies overseas, and it's primarily because, I guess, because of the weak dollar, Andy, or why is manufacturing doing relatively well?
Well, it's a weak dollar. I mean, it's going to help your exports. It kills you on import prices.
Right.
And unfortunately for the consumer, most consumer purchases, except for, food and even some of that, is imported items. You go on a Walmart shopping spree and it's all imports.
Right.
It hurts on the import side. It helps on the export side. But I think the important thing to note there is, you have to watch how the methodologies of how these numbers are calculated. You take an outfit like General Electric. Now, they're an American company, but they do most of their business overseas.
Right.
That's how they got out of paying income taxes. But when you look at that, a lot of that manufacturing is counting in U.S. manufacturing numbers because it's done by an American company. So, yes, it's done by an American company, but we're not... our country is not receiving the full benefit of that American manufacturing because the factories weren't built here. So there's construction jobs that could have been directed here. The people that are actually manning those factories are obviously not manning them here. So, there's more jobs and so forth down the line. So it's very, they say figures lie and liars figure or something like that. The cliche goes, and you really have to be careful with these methodologies. And, we ran it, we talked about the 1990s back at the beginning of the show, and we changed two very important metrics back in the 1990s. The first one was the unemployment metrics, how we go about arriving at the unemployment figures. And the second one was the consumer price index. We changed that methodology dramatically in the 1990s. And so, these things, comparing then to now is like comparing apples to watermelons, or something along those lines, because the methodologies are not lined up anymore. And then you have to make sure if you're doing it in dollar terms that, you adjust for, the variations in the purchasing power of the dollar or purchasing power parity or, another figure like that. It's very hard to go over a long period of time and analyze data and really get a valid comparison. It's very difficult.
Yeah. Well, you know, so much.
You can get trends, but it's you got to keep these things in mind.
So much of the government regulation inhibits what we do today. For example, before the ADA, the Disability, you know, Americans with Disability Act, as a result of that act, fewer disabled people are working on a percentage-wise than they were before that act was enacted. Well, that's because the way the law was written, you hire somebody, and in fact, anyone could have, you know, you can have a twitch in your left arm and you're disabled, and all of a sudden you may fall under the ADA, and it causes a heck of a problem for an employer, especially if the person is not performing. I heard also, I read recently, Tesla, that electric car costs about $120,000 or something. It looks like a spaceship, you know, but it's a electric car that goes long distances, and it's beautiful. I'd love to own one. They were fined. Now, they manufacture everything here in the United States. They were fined $235,000 by the EPA because they didn't file for a certificate of emissions. And their argument was, we didn't because there's no emissions. And yet they still had to pay the $235 for not filing. Well, you know, it's things like that, and there's thousands and thousands of other types of regulations. So we have somebody else on the line. Let's see who it is and see what their question is. Hold on, please. Caller, you're on the air.
Good evening, Joe. This is Adam in Atlanta calling.
Adam, welcome to Liberty Talk Radio. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank Andy for his informed observations and his comments this evening. I'd like to start off with a quote by the late Chalmers Johnson. He was the author of the book Blowback, if you're not familiar with him. And he once said, quote, "The stock exchange is no longer a functioning market, but is in fact a club of crooks. The ripping off of workers' pension funds, the savaging of corporate profits by inside executives, as in the case of Enron, Tyco, and WorldCom." And I'd like Andy to comment on the recent S&P downgrade of the national debt, which probably should have happened years ago. I'd like to know what his thoughts are about why S&P delayed the assessment until now, if there's some type of hidden agenda going on. And I believe that the market regained already half of what it lost since the S&P announcement. So I'm anxious to hear Andy's take on this.
Well, I can tell you, and thank you for the kind words, Adam. I'll give you my opinion on S&P and Moody's and Fitch and the rest of them. They have a credibility problem. They slapped AAA ratings on junk mortgage bonds for years and got burned rather badly. And they've been cutting European nations like Greece and Spain, Portugal, and et cetera, by two and three notches at a shot for problems that are probably about a tenth of the size of ours. And it's getting to the point, you know, they've been warning, and I try and post those articles in my blog, so if you go to my blog and look through, you can see the litany of postings about them warning and making comments and doing all of this type of machinations without actually doing anything. And I think it just finally got to the point they need to save their credibility. And they didn't actually cut the rating, but they cut the outlook, so that was like the intermediate step. The next step obviously would be to actually cut the AAA rating, and that will probably roil markets significantly when that happens, because generally, you know, the lower the rating of a bond, the higher the yield has to be. So obviously that has negative consequences for the U.S. economy if we have to pay more interest to borrow money from people. So I think they did it out of credibility or an attempt to save credibility, to save face, and you're absolutely right. The markets were hit hard right after the announcement, and then pretty much wiped out all of that loss. And you know, good times are here again, and happy days and all that kind of stuff. So So the market right. pretty much shrugged that off.
So this was damage control by S&P then?
I think so. I think, you know, and I think you'll see Moody's probably follow suit at some point because they have to. You can't just, you know, continue to look at this and say, well, yeah, this is well under control and have anybody look at you with a straight face. It's just, it's not gonna fly. So their hands are being forced basically. They're either gonna do something or they're gonna just pretty much have their credibility vaporized entirely.
Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you for calling.
Adam, thank you so much for calling and being such a loyal listener to Liberty Talk Radio. Well, Andy, it looks like we're just about plumb out of time. And again, the time flew by and we can, I had a list of questions and the subjects and we can go on probably for hours, but we're going to let you be for now and we'll save them for next month. That'd be the third Wednesday of next month if you will accept our invitation to return.
Obviously. Absolutely. I can't wait. Joe, it's always a pleasure coming on this show. This is one of the things I look forward to.
Oh, great.
We get to talk about some of these things, and the callers are educated, and they're aware, and that's great. And you've got listeners that are interested in hearing about these things. So, yes, it's absolutely my pleasure. I'd love to come back.
Okay, Andy, thank you so much for being with us this evening, and we look forward to hearing from you again.
Okay, Joe. Talk to you soon.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Wow, boy, that guy is just really, really knowledgeable. Really knowledgeable. Knows what's going on. And we should all take heed, each one of us. And now we're going to...
Political talk derived from a historical...
Wrong record.
Political talk derived from a historical...
I did that again. What's the matter with me? What is wrong with me this evening? Here we go. All righty, there's our ending song, our closing song. This is, by the way, Liberty Talk Radio is now available via iTunes for your iTunes and now Twitter for your listening convenience. Lastly, I would also like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Grant Jacobs Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. Grant Shaker's Audiology is a family hearing practice at 3227 East 31st Street in Tulsa. They may be reached at area code 918-749-7711. Call them for all your hearing needs. You'll be glad you did. Folks, you can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there is no middle ground. Folks, freedom is like riding a motorcycle, something I love to do. You feel free, liberated, your life is in your own hands. But with that freedom comes responsibility and risk. The government is like training wheels. They control the ride and your every move. Ron Paul has a sign on his desk that says, "Don't steal! The government hates competition!" With that, until next time, I'm Joe Cristiano. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Stay well. Stay tuned.